as you establish your attention on the breath as your object, your anchor object, so that you have a place to go back to when you open to wider range of experience, start to notice the pleasantness or unpleasantness, or neither pleasant nor unpleasantness, of the next inhale. And then the same with the exhale. So we're starting to see Vedana. We've done this establishment of mindfulness in body and breath. And now we're experiencing in our meditation this the mindfulness of the flavoring, this little flavoring, this little orientation. It can sometimes be quite strong where we really want something that's really sweet, pleasant, or we really dislike. But oftentimes it's only a little unpleasant or only a little pleasant. And we're hardly noticing how it's affecting us. You're not standing at the mouse hole like a cat. You're just aware. You're just including this feeling, this recognition. To get used to it, you may have to say pleasant or unpleasant. But after a while, you just know it, and it's a felt sense of that pleasant or unpleasant that's registering, not this word or concept, but the felt sense of it. Including body sensations in this now, not just the breath, but when your mind's drawn to other body sensations. Pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And notice that things can change. They can start out one way, but then they change to another. So they start out pleasant, but then it starts getting on your nerves and it becomes unpleasant. Or at first some sound or something is bothering you, but then as you just accept it and don't fight it, it becomes actually pleasant. So we're seeing the temporary nature, the temporal nature of pleasant and unpleasant, and seeing how it is not reliable for decision-making, for interpreting of reality. And now when the mind is drawn away from the breath and body, and you start planning or remembering or creating a whole rationale for something, problem solving, being creative, whatever it is that pulled the mind away, notice, was it pleasant or unpleasant that pulled the mind away? Usually it won't be neither pleasant nor unpleasant, because that doesn't have enough power to pull the mind away. But maybe sometimes, just as an escape. So you're just curious, you're not fixing anything here. There's no story that comes along with this. This is much more like the chemical level of life or something. It's not to be fixed, but it's to be seen clearly, and that's what changes it. Look closely at this experience of Vedana. Maybe you're pulled away because you're worrying about something, and that thought is unpleasant, that, oh, what if X happens? But the actual worrying about it can feel pleasant. That somehow bringing it to mind, you're kind of reassuring yourself. I call it rocking the baby. So be curious. You don't have to know, but you're being open to knowing. Now, when your mind is pulled away by pleasant or unpleasant stimuli, thoughts of some kind or body sensations, emotions, not only notice if they're pleasant or unpleasant, but do you have any choice in how you're relating in this moment? Or maybe we should actually start with just recognizing when it's unskillful, when it's dukkha, and then ask, well, do I have a choice? That would be more sequential. So it can be unpleasant, but not be dukkha itself. But when it's like, this is not a healthy direction to be going in, to recognize that, and then to just ask, do I have a choice? I'm asking you not to take the choice right now. You, of course, can anyway. I'm just wanting you to see the existence of moments of choice. Now let all the doing go and just stay with the breath body and see what you do when you go away. Just watch it, but don't do anything about it. Let's just see. we start to see how pleasant and unpleasant affect our lives in ways that we're not registering it at the time. So we can have just a series of unpleasant little moments at work and come home and just the littlest thing from our significant other just set us off. And we never really noticed that this has been conditioned in all along. Because one has to first know how to let loose of these little unpleasantness and then consciously do so. And eventually it becomes more automatic and you more drop those little unpleasant things and you're not so conditioned by them. But that takes practice, that takes time. Sumedho will say that desire is a natural energy of this realm. And he was the first person I ever heard say this some 20 years ago, because and there's what's called the dependent origination. There's a whole cycle where we take birth in this tight, clinging place, which we may or may not have time to get into tomorrow. But desire is one of the, something is pleasant or unpleasant, and then there's a natural desire arises for that. So if it's unpleasant, it's natural we'd rather it not be unpleasant. If you have a headache, you'd rather not have a headache. And so sometimes the way that all comes across is that I shouldn't desire anything at all. And he's saying, no, desire is a natural realm. It is the idealization of that which we're desiring. That is what causes us to get into trouble. We give it more weight than it deserves in our lives. And so if I just had this, then I'd really be happy. Well, we get that, and now we got to have something else because we're living on a desire-based system. So we got to have something new to desire, and then we got to get it or not get it and have all the drama about are we going to get it or not to keep going on, because we're in that cycle, you see. We're creating this thing over and over again. So there's if you've got a headache, naturally you don't want to have a headache. If you can do something to relieve yourself of the headache, relieve yourself of the headache. Just don't put anything extra on it. Oh, this is, if you're too cold and you can turn up the temperature, then turn up the temperature. Just don't make a big deal out of being too cold. You're just too cold. It's not more than that. It's not. It doesn't have end of the world ramifications in this very moment. Maybe eventually, because of climate change, it will, but not in this very moment. So that we learn to be with the dukkha and its unpleasantness, without having to be reactive to that unpleasantness. We're changing our relationship to the dukkha of that first noble truth. Likewise, and the Buddha started with dukkha because that's when you can get people's attention, but you can take sukha, this the pleasant, and you can notice the pleasant, and you can find the suffering in the pleasant. It takes a little more time and patience, but you watch yourself and watch the thoughts you have about, oh, this won't last, you know, and there you are, now you're suffering over something pleasant. Oh, I wish I did this more often. You know, and so we're trying to get more of it, or we're fussing at ourselves because we don't do it enough, or whatever it may be. And so the dukkha and sukha can both be used in a way that's unskillful and ended up in dukkha. But neither have to also in that way. Beyond the natural, the unpleasant. There's a natural unpleasantness to the headache that's going to stay there, but we don't have to add to it. So that brings us to the second noble truth, which is that there is a cause of this suffering, that there is a cause for this suffering, and that is tanha, this thirst. Then we're going to hear about three kinds of thirst in a moment. But when what can be confusing, if there's a cause of this suffering, it's not very distinguished in the text about this natural suffering versus the suffering that comes from tanha, this desire, this wanting, this clinging, grasping after. And the so for us to understand what is the relief that the Buddhist teaching is offering is our relationship to natural suffering, like if we've got a headache, and the and then the not creating this things that, oh, well, I've got to have this. That's just mental, that it's just mental suffering we're imposing on ourselves. So there's two different aspects of that. Just to stop here for a moment. Is that clear enough? So you have things in life that are difficult. It stays difficult. The Buddha's back still hurt, and he would say, Ananda, you have to teach this evening. I need to rest. Or to one or two other of his attendants, he would say, you teach so I can rest. So he was having the dukkha of life, but he wasn't caught in it. But he was responding to it, you see? So that's one whole situation. There's another situation where literally our thirst is getting us in trouble. So I don't know what it would be like. The thing that was always so painful to me would be people thinking, well, this, and it's gotten worse in some ways, I guess, the tyranny around clothes, that because the group is saying you've got to have these shoes or something, that people are suffering because they don't have something. They've got perfectly fine shoes, but they don't have those shoes. And so, you know, they rob some kid of his shoes because they want to have those shoes. That is what I mean by that second kind of suffering. There was just a story yesterday of these two people running a company and their employees reporting on how they had been abused in terms of taken advantage of work-wise, but worked so hard for underpay and told not to take their vacation time and all of this. That was tanha. That was this wanting more than they had. That they did. They didn't have to want more than they had, but they did, and they weren't then giving it back when things got better or anything like that. There was just this. That's just greed. So that's this raw greed. So those two differences. Is that clear enough? Okay. So we can be reasonably healthy about not being so greedy or so aversive in terms of extra. But the regular dukkha of life, we can be, we can really identify and make it all about ourselves this at this level of dukkha. That we, oh, you know, my life is so rough and so tough, and we feel sorry for ourselves, or we feel like we have some extra right to be angry or whatever it is. We construct something in our mind that leads to trouble. So the three kinds of thirst, the tanha, thirst, grasping, clinging, all of these different words get used different times. The first kind is sensual desire, sensual pleasure of some kind, sense desire. So that could be around food, it could be around the visual field, it could be in relation to touch, it can be in relation to hearing, and we're thirsting in one of these sense gates. The mind is the last of them. The sixth one is the mind itself. That in Buddhism it's taught as another sense. And so there's something in our minds we want. And we've all seen where we thought we wanted something and we really do all this scheming or working hard to get it, and then we don't really, it's not that great a deal one way or the other. So it's pretty easy to understand how we can make it up. But we can really be, we can start to believe that if we have all the sense desires the way we want them, then that must be the highest form of living. And Buddhism is suggesting that's not the highest form of living, so you can decide for yourself about that. So that's the first of these three, is the sense desire. And then the second is wanting to become. So we want to be something we're not. We're wanting to be healthier, better looking, different body shape, smarter, wealthier, healthier. We're wanting to become, this becoming, this wanting to be something we're not. And that is an induced misery so oftentimes, because it doesn't have an inherent betterment, what we're wanting to become. It's a perceived benefit that's not really inherently beneficial, but in our mind we're attaching an importance to it that's beyond its actual level. And then the third kind of tanha, of thirst, is not wanting to be, where we don't want to be. We don't want to be sick. We don't want to be in the dentist chair. You know, we don't want to be in this relationship. And each of those leads us to act inappropriately at times and to get caught in the situation. So many of you've heard the teaching of the two darts or the two arrows. It gets taught both ways. So you've hurt yourself. You've fallen down and you've hurt yourself. You've hurt your knees, and then I don't want to have a hurt knee, and that is like doubling down on the amount of discomfort, the amount of suffering. It's actually much more like if, let's say, there's three units of this is just an example. This is not a mathematical formula. So let's say you have three units of discomfort for some reason, emotional, physical, whatever, but your aversion to it, your aversion to the unpleasant is a 10, that you have 10 units of aversion, of 10 units of not wanting it to be. So that doesn't add up to 13, it adds up to 30. It's got some sort of more of a mathematical multiplying effect than it does just an additive. So it's not, there's no exact formula like that, but it is much closer to that than it is to just additive. So you've got some amount of discomfort and some amount of resistance to that discomfort. You would think that, okay, I've got this much of that and I've got this much of this, then together. But it's not together. It's the resistance has a much more heightening effect than just being resistance. It has the way resistance bounces through our system, it like goes back and forth a whole bunch of times. And so therefore it has that kind of multiplying effect with this. So if something bad happens to you, that's one dart. But your resistance to it, you're demanding that it be otherwise, is the second dart or the second arrow. And that's the one where we have the choice. That's where we have the choice, because we don't have to have that second dart. We can't resist if something unpleasant has happened to us. That's already happened. That's done. Or if we think it's going to happen, we can certainly try to avoid it. But if it happens anyway, then it's happened. The resistance, it's demanding that life be other than it is not a very successful formula for well-being. And yet we will do that. And in my role, so many times people are still demanding a better past. And, I eventually will say in one way or the other, and how is that turning out, you know? Because the past is the past. The thing about the past is that how we respond to it in this moment, in my experience, you have to see for yourself, in my experience, you can actually redeem the past. You can't change the past, but you can take it from meaningless suffering, from unfair suffering, from some sort of a terrible thing to something that was meaningful by how you come to understand it and relate to it and learn from it. That, and so that the way you're behaving in this moment and the moment going forward has this redemption of the past, and the way it's held, once there's some meaning to it, lightens this terrible thing in the past. And again, I've seen this hundreds of people by now, so I can report this as a general experience, but I can't report it that it will happen to you that way. But this, do you know what I mean by redeeming the past? That you redeem it by you give it meaning. And when something, human beings will can tolerate all sorts of terrible things if there's a meaning to it. But they can't if it's meaningless. It's what is so devastating is meaninglessness. Just meaningless. It wipes us out. So, I'll give you one little example of a person who was physically and in some ways, because some of the physical stuff had a sexual implication, great abuse by his mother, actually. And he had been in the Dharma world for a long time. And he came to this retreat and he was telling me all of this, and he'd tell me all the things he'd done and all the therapy he'd been done. And really a very fine person. I liked him a lot. But I introduced this sort of idea, and I took him through a series of questions that led him to having this view, and it made such a difference. And over time, it was a number of sessions that we went through this together in. And then one of the things that I said, so how about you as a parent? And he says, well, what do you mean? And I said, so have you been a parent like your mother? No, of course not. I'd never do anything like that. So she was your teacher. She taught you via the negative, which is a terrible way to learn oftentimes, but that's the truth of it. That's what she could give you was through the negative. She couldn't give you through the positive. Why that was and all doesn't matter to him. What matters to him is what he does with it. You see, so the narrative of this happened to her because of that's all useful in one sense, but in another sense, it's like, okay, what do I do with what is? It's like this, so what do I do with it? Coming from my value systems. Let it clarify my values, and then let it incite me to live, inspire me to live from my value systems. And one of his was non-harming, of course. And that shift in attitude means that instead of getting nothing, he did get something. But it's a terrible way to get something. But it is still getting something. And I bet you there's a number of us in this room that if we looked at our lives, if I ask you a few questions, we'd see the same thing for you, right? You know who you are out there. I'm one of those people. I got a lot through the negative. But I did get it. I did, and I happened to realize that earlier than most people, so I didn't have the kind of anger and all that. But that's where it came from. It was a tough way to get it. But nonetheless, I was made stronger in some way by my experience. And I had great clarity about what I valued and what I didn't value at an early age. And that gave me opportunities that if I'd had a more asleep kind of childhood, it's not clear that I would have done. You know, it's just not clear that because my mind wasn't. My mind has a natural willingness to drift. It's always had that. It does not. It is not an ambitious mind in its own way. I'm highly curious, but I'm not curious towards necessarily. I learned to be. I learned to move towards accomplishment. I did not have a natural, again, because of conditioning and birth, I did not have this, like, oh, I want to accomplish this or I want to accomplish that. It came out of circumstances that I became a person who accomplished. It was just my mind was perfectly content to just be interested and not accomplish. Still to this day, and I've spent a lot of time accomplishing in my life, and it's been a benefit to others that I've done so. But it's not so with you, there's things with you that you may not be looking at in the fullness of the experience. You're looking at it only from the narrative that was your narrative when you were 5 years old or 10 years old. And it's a true narrative. I'm not in any way dismissing the narrative. But the overall effect of it can be different. And maybe you've not reaped the harvest that you have sown. I've said to numerous people through these years, you know, you've done all the suffering. So you've grown a crop from your suffering, but you've not harvested your crop. You're leaving it lying out there in the field. It's just going to waste. Harvest what your experience is. And this is part of what I mean by that. So again, any question here about this? So the instruction in the second noble truth, the second ennobling truth, and so in the first ennobling truth was that we were ennobled by feeling the ouch, standing under, being willing to bear, to carry the suffering. The second, so the second insight of the second noble truth is different. It is that the instruction is you penetrate tanha you by letting loose of the cause of it. So you let loose of the cause of suffering. So before you were just feeling the ouch of it, but now you're letting loose of the cause of suffering. That's the second noble truth. Not the third noble truth, which most people, because that's the end of, third noble truth is like the end of suffering. But right here, we start practicing letting loose. That's the second noble truth. That's our practice. We see where our mind is clinging, where we're grasping, and as best we're able, we let loose. We let loose of this, of this grasping. So we're holding on to something. This is a clock. It's useful. I need this clock. But I'm holding on to it. Now, after a while, this would get very tiring. You know, my arm would hurt. My shoulder would be frozen. I would be really characterized by holding this clock. Although there's nothing inherently wrong with the clock. But my relationship with the clock is not wise. Pretty clear, right? So what we do is we put it down. We do not have to throw it away. We don't have to get rid of it, smash the clock. So even if it's something that is really not to be picked up at all, it's a radioactive clock and you don't want to touch that, still you don't have to smash it. You just leave it alone. You just leave it alone. And this is the letting loose of the demand for our sense desires to be met. Letting loose of our demand that we be able to be something other than we are. Letting loose of our demand that we not be as we are, or this moment not be as it is. That's the practice. We practice letting loose as best we're able. As best we're able. As best we're able. As best we're able in this moment. So, as what? As best we're able. This is, it took me years to get that for myself. And that freed me from so much judging and theorizing and all this. Because I have an honest relationship with that phrase. When I say as best, I am doing it as best I am able, I am. But I'm going to fail a lot too. So rather than judge all this and that, Looking at the general pattern, do I live as best I am able? And am I walking my talk as best I am able in general? Not like every time am I for sure doing it? That'll drive you crazy. And it'll spin you into confusion. But you have an integrity. You have a relationship with yourself that you're letting loose as best you're able of this kind of grasping over what we want. And again, I'm not saying to you, the Buddha did not say let loose of all desire. It's just that it's our relationship to the desire. We're letting loose of those parts of desiring that causes the suffering. And how do you know if you're doing that? Suffering lessens. That's how you know. But you don't measure for a while. You're not like the little boy who wanted to grow carrots and every day would go out and dig it up to see if his carrots had started to grow. That doesn't work very well. So we have to be patient as we tend our garden in this way. But it does happen for us. Then the third inside of the second noble truth is that the cause of suffering has been let go of. So we know what that feels like. And it can be just in one aspect of our lives, or just one person in one situation, or one old story, but we actually get a feel for it anywhere. And this is this knowing we know in relation to it, the insight that we've followed these insights and we discover that it's worked. We really go back and say, okay, so did this work or not? Did this really bring the end of suffering? So we have seen for ourselves that we can let loose of what we're clinging to, and that in letting loose of what it's clinging to, it does change. In that situation, for that moment, our attachment that's causing the suffering, that we see that this is, we see the truth of this, and we do it consciously so we can integrate it, so we don't have those three gaps. We live with more conviction, and we live with a kind of immediacy, which is not the same as urgency, but this immediacy that it is only in this moment that I can respond. So, wow, I want to respond in this moment. Also, I want to be organized in such a way that, oh yeah, I'm alert. I can, because I know for myself that if I respond wisely, it makes a difference in the suffering I cause myself and others, or that others can cause me. It makes a difference, but it's immediate, because the only time that we have choice is in the here and now. We're not in the past, and we're not in the future. So if we're going to respond to our understanding, to our feelings, to an emotion, to a situation, now, here. Now, here, and but it's not like it's like here now. The integrity of our living provides a kind of grounding feeling, so that we respect and trust ourselves that we're going to respond as best we're able. I'm pointing to this, incorporating all of this in a way that is empowering. But again, this is not quite conventional to be talking this way. But I'm hoping that it's registering with you, that you can we can't do some big analysis of every moment of our lives. Those moments are long gone. We've already created, 25 other unskillful thoughts by then. So it's developing a habit, developing pattern, having a view that's an automatic view. So we used to view it this way, and now we view it this way. And when we viewed it this way, this led us into all of this trouble. But at least in this one area of our life, or with this one person, we now view it this way. And because our view has switched, we don't have to do any of that stuff. We just view it more wisely now. And if we're wrong, we go, oh, That didn't turn out right. I've still more to learn here. So our failure becomes part of what informs our success, just like playing the scales on the piano. You're going to make mistakes, a lot of mistakes, if you're going to be a good piano player. How are you going to do it? Life is like that. How do you become wise? By being unwise. But you don't have to be unwise in the same way over and over again. And so, again, looking at this from empowerment, closing that gap, being able to actually have the Dhamma be more alive in our life from an organized point of view of, I am about this, and I have dignity, I respect myself, I'm about this, and I will do as best I am able with whatever level of knowledge, insight I have. And so that's how I'm organized, that's my perception. So something may be something I want, but I just want it. It's not more than that. I don't make it, I don't reify it, I don't make it happy ever after. Because there's not anything like that that's happy ever after. There's things that we'd happily give our lives for, but that doesn't mean it'd be happily ever after. Most parents would in a second give their life for one of their children or even grandchildren and so forth. But that doesn't mean that grandchild is therefore happily ever after, or the grandparent is happily ever after, or the parent is happily ever after. Do you understand? So there's things you value, but they're valued in the context of this moment. And it's in this moment you act appropriately, which might mean you push the child out of the way and the bus runs over you. That's an appropriate response. But you push the child out of the way and you get out of the way, that doesn't mean you're going to be happy ever after, even though you made this huge, wonderful, heroic, sacrificial act in a given moment. But that was in that moment, but now that moment's gone. There's not another bus coming now. Now you're back in the regular business of life with all of its stickiness. Do you see? And so I'm pointing you to how the Dhamma provides a perspective, a base of seeing that allows us to meet the moments of life as they unfold here and now. And we don't have to be more than we are because we can't be more than we are. But if we are at the edge of our development, then we are gradually becoming the bhavana. In Theravada Buddhism, there's sila, ethical behavior, there's dana, this generosity, and there's bhavana, this becoming. In the old days in Southeast Asia, they would not teach the meditation, which is the big key to the bhavana, till they felt like you'd learn the first two, that you had, and part of that was this idea that you don't want to move people into too much freedom of view until they've gotten imprinted with ethical behavior and generosity, because there's times in your development that the idea of social convention just falls away, and a lot of teachers have gotten lost in that. Don't have to name names, but a lot have. But it falls away, and it falls away naturally. It's not like, that's not an indulgence. There's perspectives that as you're going along are just different than the social convention. You're not, it's just different views come up for a while. And then they get integrated in. But for a while, I mean, all sorts of things are different along the way. So. But without this kind of training, and the reinforcement of the training and so forth. Okay, this integration of the letting loose of that we know that we have let loose and we know we can let loose, then the exploration in our life is, wow, I can feel that I'm really got clinging in this. Well, this is all so sticky for me. Do I have choice in this moment to let loose of some of that stickiness? Now, it may be that to let loose of that stickiness, you have to stop fighting so hard for it, And but it but you when you go if it's if the who I'm becoming to try to get what I want, it's not worth it. And so you stop fighting for it. And but this could be like some big job, some title or something that's where you're having to play political games, which are not very wholesome political games and companies, as some of you would well know about those political games and companies. Or it could be basically saying, parents who are older who have children who have kids and all, there can be a temptation sometimes to blackmail them, basically, with your support. That where you kind of get what you want in terms of access to your grandchildren or having them treat you, the parents have to come, where you basically are blackmailing your children and you're using your power in a way that's not generous. That happens in life. Maybe you never did that or never even had the thought of that, but someone you know has sometime, or maybe your parents have done that to you. So we go, this is not the way I wish to live. So we let loose of all of that, even though it seems like then we're not, that we just know that we're going to be treated harshly on the other side by our children or by whomever it is. But it doesn't turn out that way necessarily. It turns out that when we're not clinging, that doesn't mean we're pushovers. And if, again, our own integrity creates a different field of interaction. And in that field of interaction is more likely, in my experience base, over a period of time to bring more of that which we seek that's wholesome than our clinging. I don't think clinging is that great a strategy over a period of time. In a given moment, it allows you to compromise yourself in all sorts of ways so that you can get what you want, maybe, maybe not. But over a period of time, that's not a repeated successful strategy as a rule. There's certain areas and there's certain very well-known people who have acted this way for decades and have gotten away with it in big parts of their life. And you can say, oh, but they must be miserable inside. But I don't know if they're miserable inside. How would I know that? Maybe they're not miserable at all inside. Because they're not put together that way, but most of us are put together the way I'm saying, and you can again to know all of this, you're going to have to choose to make the Dhamma more central to your life. You're going to have to step into, I'm going to live a more ethical life, a more generous life, a more non-clinging life, and I'm going to practice enough, in whatever way, if 10 minutes a day might be, that's enough practice because that's all you can afford time-wise, but you do that 10 minutes a day so that you can remember all this, so that you can arrive, in whatever situation you're in, you arrive with your mindfulness, you arrive with your aspiration, and you arrive with your intention. So this is the way it gets put together in a lived way. And now we're going to walk again. And this time in our walking, I would like you to with each step, be stepping into the Dhamma. And so you're walking 10 to 20 steps, maybe 30, but not 30, I think, gets on the edge of like you're going to get spacey. Whatever number of steps, and each step is a step into the Dhamma. So you're stepping forward. You're seeing what it feels like to step into living from the perspective of the Dhamma, that I'm going to trust the Dhamma. I'm going to trust this way of viewing life, and I want to see what it feels like. So I'm just stepping into it. Then you don't think anything more about it. And then at the end of your, when you get to the end of your walking, your 20 steps or whatever, go, how does it feel right now? Just notice your body, notice your heart, notice your head center, and just how does it feel? You just ask, and just get a quick weather report. Walk back, do the same again at the end of that 20 steps. Where you're just going, what does it feel like to be being orienting this way. You're just noticing. And it's not supposed to feel any particular way. It cannot feel anything. It can feel like, well, this is tedious. That's okay, too. Because sometimes it is very tedious. So you're just, you're rehearsing having a different perspective. You tracking me? This is a way to practice. And I have other exercises I do with the walking meditation that have proven helpful to people. So let's see how this one works for you. And our second group will...
E through K
will be next door. And again, anyone that wasn't this morning but won't be here tomorrow. And then we will come back we'll start coming back at 5 after. So let's try to be, we want to start at 10 after 4. Okay?